Yes.
Well, welcome everyone. Thank you all very much for coming, taking time out of your busy schedules. There are a few seats we reserved in the front row here for some special guests and persons who come late. The back row usually fills up first. So please, you can come up to the front. Yes, thank you all very much for coming, taking time out of your busy schedules to come and get the association of very wonderful and exalted personality. We are blessed and greatly honored to have with us here tonight one of Srila Prabhupada's dear, dear disciples, wonderful teacher, wonderful speaker, charismatic kirtan leader.
Oh my God.
I got my book here. 700 verses of glorification. and very, very special and wonderful, wonderfully inspiring personality in my own life. So I really appreciate and thank her for coming. So Mother Irmala is here with us this evening, and she will be speaking about the removing of anartas within the heart. Is there anyone who's here for the very first time? This is your kind of first seminar you're attending. Oh, wonderful. Very inspiring. Okay.
Can you sleep in 5 minutes?
Yeah. For me. Yeah. So I can get some rocks in the pack.
Actually, out of the pack.
Out of my pack.
Can you stay for this? It's 5 minutes.
Okay. So please, I would request everyone to join me in expressing our gratitude and appreciation to Mother Irmala. She has a very busy schedule. She is on the most wanted list all over the world. And somehow we've managed to get her here.
That's because this is one of my favorite places to come to.
I'll pay you for that later. So please, if you can join me in expressing our gratitude and appreciation to Mother Irmala, I encourage her to keep coming back and feel most welcome here at her home in the center of London by raising our arms and chanting very, very loudly, three, Hari Om!
Hari Om! Hari Om! Hari Om!
Embrace Mother Irmala Ki!
Okay, if we could start with the lights off. It's just a short, about 5 minutes. Okay, everybody ready?
Yes.
Have a seat. Can I type who? You can give one of these VIP seats in the front. We go till what time? Johnny Taku, what time do we end?
We need to go until we close the temple at 9:30.
Well, I'm not going to bell.
Okay, so anytime before that is okay.
8 o'clock.
Rocks in my pack. A fable. There are 16 rocks in my fort, said Jiva, and there are 10 rocks in my tower. I have red rocks, green rocks, and tan rocks. I have little rocks and big rocks. They are fun. I like my rocks. Oh, I think that boat is going to Krishna. I want to go to Krishna right now. I do not want to wait at all, said Jiva. I'll put the rocks in my pack and bring them on that boat. I want to go to Krishna. Is this boat going there? Yes, I have just come from Krishna. Now I will bring this boat back there, the boatman said. Can I come in the boat now? Said Jiva. Said the boatman. You have to be light and free. I do not think that pack is light. What is in the pack? There are some little rocks and big rocks in my pack, said Jiva. The pack is not light. If the rocks come in the boat, You will sink down with the rocks, the boatman says. The boat will sink too. You must get all the rocks out of the pack, said the boatman. You cannot bring one little rock. This rock is green, and that one is red, Jiva said. It is hard to put them down and not bring them. They are fun. I do want to go to Krishna, but I want to keep my rocks too. When you are with Krishna, then you will have fun with him. That fun is light and free, said the boatman. Then I will put the rocks down. Will you help me get them all out now? Asked Jiva. Yes, said the boatman. Look, Jiva, there is Krishna now, said the boatman. And the pack of rocks stayed on the other shore.
I hope you like that. Okay, we turn on the lights. So we're going to look tonight at how do we get in the boat? How do we get the rocks out of our pack and get in the boat? So in one very real sense, bhakti yoga is not so much about getting rid of unwanted habits and vices and things about ourselves that we don't like. It's really about becoming who we are, realizing who we are, awakening who we are. And that real person, who we are, is naturally free of all vices and bad habits and bad qualities and all that kind of thing. As soon as we awaken to who we are, then naturally we don't have any unwanted qualities. Now, other forms of yoga are much more concerned with getting rid of the nasty stuff, with purification, with getting free of an artist. As you saw for little Jiva, when did he decide to get the rocks out of his pack? He decided to get the rocks out of his pack when he became so attracted to Krishna. And he said, oh, I can have fun with Krishna. Okay, I'll get rid of the rocks if it means that I can have fun with Krishna. So our bhakti yoga process is that we get so attracted to Krishna and that we so much want spiritual life that naturally we're no longer interested in the things in our life which drag us down and the things which are different from what we really want to be. I think for most of us in this world, there's a big difference, or maybe for some of you there's a very small difference, between the person we would like to be or the person we imagine we are and the person we actually deal with on a regular basis. You know, we have the self we see in the mirror and the self we have to deal with, and then we have our kind of ideal self somewhere in the clouds. And at least for me, right, almost every day, if not more than one time a day, we do something, we think something, we say something that is not really what we want to be. We disappoint ourselves. I mean, not only do other people disappoint us, pretty much everyone in our life disappoints us to some extent, yes? We also have an idealized self for all the other people in our life. What's the ideal mother, ideal father, ideal husband, ideal wife, ideal son, daughter, brother, sister, boss, employee, and the other people we deal with also fall short, right? I thought you were going to be the perfect sister. I thought you were going to be the perfect, you know, employee, and I find out that you're not. And often when we have this disparity between what we think that somebody should be and what we find out they are, we can become very disappointed and very angry. But looking at ourselves, we tend to have the same difficulty that we have. Okay, who do I want to be? Who do I imagine that I am? Who would I like to be? And we're confronted over and over and over and over and over and over again that who we want to be, or who we imagine ourselves to be, or who we project ourselves as being, who we would like to tell other people we are, you know, who we put on our resume and in our little biography. A lot of times people ask me, you know, give me your biography. And, you know, you don't write on your little biographical sketch, you know, yelled at so-and-so over nothing. Got annoyed with someone else for doing something that I ended up doing myself an hour later. You know, decided that I was going to lose some weight and sat down and ate a big piece of cake. You know, we don't put that on our biography. You know, decided I was going to read with attention, and instead of that, just spaced out and did nothing. So, you know, but these are the things that wear on us. And we try to get rid of these bad habits. We try to become our idealized self, but we fail over and over again. I mean, we're able to do some things sometime to some extent. And certain things we're able to change about ourselves with great endeavor over a long period of time. And even then, they're not 100%. Isn't it like that? You know, you have something about yourself that you're like, I can't want to fix this. I want to change this. I want to improve this. And you work really, really hard for a very long time. Maybe, you know, you go to seminars, you read books and whatever. You know, you get some coaching and you work really, really, really hard. And you think, okay, I've gotten this right. And then someone you love says, why are you doing this? Why am I doing that? I don't do that anymore. Well, you just did it 5 minutes ago. No, I don't do that anymore. I've given up. Right. So in thinking about this, you know, why is this the case? This is a pretty universal human experience, that the person that we would like to be, the person we advertise ourselves as being, is different from the person that we live with. And we just don't seem to get anywhere. It becomes very discouraging. I remember a song when I was young, you know, about this guy saying, I can't do what 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll just remain the same. And it often feels like that, right? Other people come to you and say, you know, you really have a problem with this, or you really have a problem with that. It just doesn't seem to go away. So other systems of yoga are more interested in looking at the problems and getting rid of the problems. But Bhakti Yoga is looking at the positive. So I want to look at first the material way of getting rid of the problems, the yoga, like Asanga Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Karma Yoga way of getting rid of the problems, and then the Bhakti Yoga way of getting rid of the problems. So the material way of getting rid of our problems is to try to move up. Some of you in the back can't see me, can you? So you know what? I am going to stand up. So I'm going to be way too high for you guys in front. Get up a chair.
Should solve that.
Yeah, that would solve the problem. I don't know how we turn that off. Okay, thanks. So the material way of getting rid of our problems is to move up through the modes of material nature. That's how you try to get rid of your problems materially. So as I'm sure most of you know, there's three modes of material nature. And Krishna explains this extensively in the Bhagavad Gita. There's goodness, passion, and ignorance. I was just reading where Prabhupada said that in goodness there's actual knowledge, in passion there's material enjoyment without much knowledge, and in ignorance there's neither enjoyment nor knowledge. So basically, in the mode of ignorance, which is very much what the animals are in, you're doing bad things, you have bad character, and you're not even aware of it. Your awareness of your own faults is very low. So when someone's covered by the mode of ignorance, they think, you know, I'm already great, I'm already perfect, I already have everything together. I'm sure we all know people like this. You know, if you ever point out any fault in them, they become furious. Ben, have you met people like this? You know, even some small thing. You know, you forgot to put more paper in the copy. What do you mean? Somebody else was. Even something that's not a character flaw, they become very angry. What to speak of a character flaw? If you say to someone in the mode of ignorance, you know, you're acting a little selfish, or they're not able to hear it at all. So someone, when we're covered by the mode of ignorance, we're really almost completely unaware of our own failings. We see ourselves as already perfect. Of course, even in the mode of ignorance, someone in their heart of hearts is aware, I'm not quite what I want to be, but they're not willing to face it. Now, in the mode of passion, you're also not really able to see your faults. You know, a little bit, because you don't really have much knowledge. But in the mode of passion, at least you're trying to be a good person. Mode of ignorance, you don't care. You know, mode of ignorance, all you care about is getting your coffee and donuts and going home and watching the television, and you know, that's about it. But in the mode of passion, you're thinking, I'm really going to be a good person. I'm going to give charity. I'm going to be kind. So you're working at having good qualities. But also in passion, people are not really willing to see their faults. A little bit more than in ignorance. A little bit more. But at least they're trying to be good. And in goodness, you can actually see yourself honestly. You can look in your heart and you can see, wow, this thing is nice and this thing is not nice. You're able to understand how things are working. So materially, the way to improve yourself is coming from ignorance to passion, where in ignorance you don't care if you do nasty things, in passion you try to be good, to goodness where you can see things clearly. Now the difficulty is that coming from ignorance to passion or passion to goodness is very difficult. Each of us has a particular body that's made up of a certain combination of these goodness, passion, ignorance, according to our previous desires and previous karma. And so our body and our mind tend to go in that mold. It's already made of a particular mold. So we have a tendency, kind of like a car with a steering wheel that's off kilter. So we have a tendency to keep going in the same combination of the modes that produce this particular body. We also have a tendency to go in the modal combination of our family, our upbringing, and our society. It's very, very difficult for us. We have to really work hard to change the combination of the modes that we're in. And this is why when we try to make material changes to our character, it's such hard work. You know, your steering wheel's going that way, and you gotta, you know, do this. And it's psychologically burdensome also. Right? You have to be constantly aware of what you're doing wrong, and then you have to intentionally endeavor to do the right thing. Sometimes you don't notice what you're doing wrong. Sometimes you forget to do the right thing. Sometimes you're not sure what the right thing is. Right? And then because the modes in nature are constantly shifting, so at different times of the day are governed by different modes. Like early morning, there's a time in the early morning when all the modes are in balance. Then there's a time when goodness is dominant, then passion, and then ignorance. And then during the year also, with the changes of the seasons, the particular combination of the modes change. Also according to the environment that you're in. And then for each of us also, if any of you know anything about astrology, so for each of us, depending on the particular astrological combination at the particular time, we'll be affected differently by different modes. So depending on where our particular planets are situated, as the planets move in the sky, they will affect us differently. It's like it's kind of like you can think that we have a particular pitch that we're vibrating at, and we'll tend to resonate when that same pitch is in the environment, and when it isn't, we tend to have a difficult time. This is why you'll find sometimes when certain people become very creative and other people become lethargic. It's not that everybody in the world feels creative at the same time. Everybody feels energetic at the same time. Because the modes resonate with us differently according to our particular combination. So you can change the modes of nature that you're in, but it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. You have to change the nature of your body and mind, and you have to change how you're responding to the environment. And one reason that these things tend not to stay is that when the modes are mostly in ignorance, it's going to bring out the ignorance in you. And this is why we have the problem that we think we solve a problem. Okay, I've solved this. And then all of a sudden, we haven't solved it. You know, there's some circumstance. Maybe you don't get angry for 3 years or 4 years or 5 years. And then all of a sudden, we're in a situation where we become furious. Wow, I thought I wasn't getting angry anymore. What's that all about? And that we've seen this with any kind of vice. You know, we've seen people who've been austere and celibate for years and years and years, and then they have an affair with somebody. It just happened to someone I know, in fact. So this sort of thing happens, right? Or somebody's always honest, and then in some situation they become tempted and they do something dishonest. So this is because if you try to stay in the mode of goodness just materially, it's extremely, extremely difficult. When the mode of passion, the mode of ignorance becomes dominant in the environment, then those things within ourself will tend to respond. And people who study astrology also see that, you know, we go through different phases astrologically, so we may go through some phase where it's very easy to be the kind of person we want to be, and then we may go through some phase where it's very difficult for us to be the kind of person that we want to be. So materially, we can say it's almost impossible to be an ideal person all of the time. As long as we're just under the influence of the modes, we are to some extent a puppet of the modes. So we can choose what mode we want to be controlled by, but we're still being controlled by the modes of nature. And being purely controlled by goodness is almost impossible. It's just almost impossible. And this is why you'll find, you know, self-help courses, self-help books, coaching, all these things we do. If they bring you up to passion and goodness, they will work to some extent some of the time. But they don't work across the board. So you put up in a tremendous amount of endeavor, and then to maintain it is also very, very difficult. We have so many stories in our scriptures, like in the Bhagavatam, of personalities who achieved the mode of goodness but weren't able to maintain it in all circumstances. So many stories. We have stories not only of people here on this planet, but higher celestial beings who have great powers and are definitely mostly in the mode of goodness. And then something happens where the modes of ignorance and passion that are still in them will come out. So therefore we say, yes, one can take material help to get rid of our bad habits and our bad qualities. And those things will work to some extent, some of the time, or most of the time. But if that's all one is doing, one will be disappointed. If that's all one's doing, one will be disappointed. You know, at best, one can get a higher body on a higher planet in one's next birth. So then there are systems of yoga like Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, and Dhyana Yoga. Dhyana Yoga is also called Astanga Yoga, that seek to just remove all of the dirt from the heart and bring one to something called Shuddha Sattva, or pure goodness, where there's no tinge of passion and ignorance. So if you can come to pure goodness without any tinge of passion and ignorance, then one will be able to maintain one's ideal character. But how do these work? So these work something like this, that in those forms of yoga, they assume that you have a cup full of some sort of chemical juice. All right? Right? They have that here, right? I know we have it in America. You can all tell I'm from America, yes? So we have that in America. We have the chemical juice. You go to the, what do you call it, the hypermarket, right?
Supermarket.
Oh, you call it supermarket now. Oh, that's good. I never liked hypermarket, so I was like, the hypermarket. So you go to the supermarket, and you buy these big jugs, right, of this chemical juice. It's pretty much just water with a little color and a little chemical flavor and a whole bunch of sugar. So if you have that in your cup, that's like having bad qualities. So Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, and Dhyana Yoga say, empty your cup. Have an empty cup. Especially Karma Yoga and Jnana Yoga. And Karma Yoga says the way that you get your cup empty is you do all the same things that somebody would do in the mode of passion or maybe even the mode of goodness, but you don't do them for any personal gain. You do them for the sake of purification. So you're still a good person in the world. You know, you're kind, you're considerate, you're forgiving, you're charitable, you're responsible, and all nonviolent, and all these wonderful qualities. But you're not doing that so you can enjoy the world. You're not doing that so you can go to the higher planet, so you can become rich, you can become famous. You're doing it out of a sense of duty, not duty like obligation, but you're doing it out of a sense of, this is the right thing to do and it will get me purified. Let me offer what I'm doing to the service of the Lord. But the Lord in a very general way. The Lord is like the all-pervasive light and the spiritual and not so much in a personal relationship. So that's karma yoga. And by karma yoga, Krishna explains in the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, one does in fact become peaceful and one does enter into the mode of goodness. Then jnana yoga, the system of jnana yoga, is that you empty your cup of all of your chemical juice through philosophy. You study the nature of the world. You become disinterested in being a materialist through logic and philosophy. And so that's not difficult to do for a short period of time for most of us. For example, if someone we really love dies, we often feel very detached for a while. We think, you know, what's the use of life? What's the use of being materialistic? I remember when my mother was dying, I was with her for the last 3 weeks of her life in an old age home. And wow, if you really want to be detached, hang out in an old age home. Wow. I mean, you know, the people there often had very successful material lives, and now they were there with nothing. Many times they didn't even have a memory. You know, you go up to people and say, you know, were you married? Yeah, no, I don't remember. How many children do you have? Three, two, I don't remember. And you just think all these things that people work for in their lives and accumulate in their lives, it's all gone. I remember they introduced one man to me. He was like a famous chef in a New York restaurant, and now he's just eating, you know, the old age chum food. And boy, you get really, really detached. And I remember when we buried my mother in the cemetery, so I had been named after her auntie. And she was buried right near the auntie I was named after, and there was my name on the tombstone. That was quite an experience. Walk in the cemetery to bury your mother, and there's your own name right there. The cemetery on the tombstone. You know, and those sort of experiences make you very detached. You know, seeing my mother. And she had nothing at the end, you know, even her body didn't, at least her mind worked, but her body just didn't work at all. And she had, you know, plaques on the room, thank you for giving $1 million to this charity, and another million to that charity, and what good did it do her? It was useless. You know, and she had her newspaper paper clippings, how she had been a beauty queen, and now she certainly wasn't a beauty queen. I mean, it was like a... And you look at that and you become detached and you think, what is the use? What is the use of accumulating money and fame and beauty and knowledge? My mother was very educated and knowledgeable and articulate. At the end, she couldn't even speak. She couldn't even communicate. And what is the use? So this is called Gyan Yoga, that you study the nature of reality in a philosophical way. And you conclude, why am I working to accumulate so many things? One of my friends just sent me a little story that this European tourist was in India, and she saw one yogi living in a little room with just a mat on the floor. And she says, well, where's your furniture? And he looked at her and says, well, where's your furniture? She says, well, I'm just visiting. I'm just here temporarily. He said, so am I. So that's Gyan Yoga. That's Gyan Yoga. You know, our life is just a flash. Everything's temporary. It doesn't give deep spiritual satisfaction. And therefore, just empty your cup of all material endeavor and come to pure goodness. And then there's Dhyan Yoga. So Dhyan Yoga is, I'm sure you're all familiar with the different parts of Ashtanga Yoga. So you start, first of all, being a good person and not being a bad person. And then you physically put your body and breath in such a way as to make your mind very calm and peaceful, to stop the jumping of the mind. Right? Generally, our minds are something like monkeys. If any of you have ever been to India and you've seen the monkeys, right? And they're constantly
jumping. My daughter lived in India for 7 years, and she was saying, you know, if you hang up your laundry, especially the teenage monkeys, they'll take down the laundry, not because they're going to wear the clothes, you know, but just simply to be naughty. You know, they'll take it down, they'll rip it up, and they'll jump on it, and all that kind of thing, just simply to cause trouble. Right? They'll go to the water tanks, and they'll open up the water, not because they want to drink the water, but just because it's fun, you know, so they have to put all these thorns on top of the water tank. So often our mind is like that, right? Our mind is just jumping around and making a mess and et cetera, et cetera. So in Dhyana Yoga, you control the mind not through detached work like in Karma Yoga and not through philosophical meditation like in Gyan Yoga, but through putting the body and the breath in such a way that the mind becomes peaceful. So the mind, being a machine, can be controlled by mechanical processes. And then once you put the mind in a peaceful state, you then detach the senses from the external world. Something like what we all do automatically every night in deep sleep. When we go into deep sleep, we don't hear anything. You know, it has to be a really loud alarm to wake us up from deep sleep. We don't see anything. We have no awareness of our environment at all. Nothing. I mean, it's practically like being under some kind of anesthesia when we're in deep sleep. All the senses are withdrawn. Now, the difference between Dhyana Yoga and deep sleep is that in Dhyana Yoga, the intelligence remains awake. So in deep sleep, not only is the mind quiet, but the intelligence also is quiet. And we basically have no consciousness at all. But in Dhyana Yoga, you keep the soul active and the intelligence active. And the mind goes to sleep. The mind is the accepting, rejecting function. The mind is like the gatekeeper. So you like drug the mind kind of with the breathing and the postures so that it just goes to sleep. And then whatever you focus on, you can focus on with full concentration. Because the mind isn't jumping anymore. It's quiet. And then with the intelligence, you fix your consciousness inwardly on the form of the Lord in the heart. Or some people in Dhyana Yoga fix their consciousness on just the pervasive light. And by doing that, you lose all interest and all awareness in anything material, and by focusing on the Lord, one revives one's original state of pure goodness. Now you can see that all three of these methods are extremely difficult. First of all, to do Karma Yoga, you have to start out being a very pious and good person, which for most of us at the present time is quite difficult. Our society and our environment are mitigating against the kind of pious life that's described in the scriptures. Even most of us who think we're good people, if you look at what are the rules in the scriptures for being a good person, frankly, most of us fall short. And that's true all over the world. It doesn't really matter whether in the UK or you're in China or you're in India or you're in Brazil or... There's very, very few people that are able to follow all of the detailed rules of the scriptures in our modern society. What to speak of doing everything without trying to enjoy the result? It's really, really difficult for us. Okay, I'm going to do this just for purification. I don't care about success or failure, happiness or distress. Whatever happens, I'm not going to try to enjoy the result. I'm just doing it for purification. Extremely difficult. And Jnana Yoga is also very difficult. You know, we can have some detachment when we see our name on a tombstone in a cemetery, but it doesn't last. A week after that, you know, it becomes just theory. The shock value kind of wears off. And practically, you have to live your life. You know, you can't really live a life thinking I'm going to die at every moment and life is temporary and materially useless. I mean, how do you function like that? You know, it's very difficult to function like that in the world. You practically have to go away from the world and sit in the cave somewhere and live on roots and berries. And in fact, that's what the yogis would do. Because as soon as you're going to work and you're taking care of your family and you're paying the bills and you're doing this and you're doing that, how can you keep right in front of you that this life is temporary and everything's going to fall through my fingers like sand and why should I be attached to it anyway? Right? And people ask this all the time. You know, well, how do I do this? How do I function in the world with detachment? Because the people who tried to be detached that way, frankly, my dear friends, were not trying to function in the world. The karma yogis were trying to function in the world, but to give up the results. And then dhyana yoga is even harder. Before you can even do dhyana yoga, before you can do asanga yoga, you have to have become perfect in the first karma yoga or dhyana yoga. And generally, it's first karma yoga, then dhyana yoga, then dhyana yoga. Because unless you've already become peaceful by detached work, and unless you've already become detached through philosophical understanding, you're not going to be able to sit all day, every day, in pratyahara, where your senses aren't interacting with the outside world. This won't be able to do it. You have to have already a large amount of internal detachment. I mean, maybe you can do it for 15 minutes, or an hour, or 2 hours, but all day, every day. And Krishna says to do this kind of yoga, you leave society, you go to a secluded place, you know, you don't have any family relation, it's only for people who are going to be completely celibate, you just eat whatever fruit is available in the forest, which would be pretty hard here in the UK in the winter altogether. You know, if you went to Hawaii, that would be easy, but here it would be a little difficult. But just to be able to do that, you know, so there are a lot of people who meditate for 15 minutes a day. But that's not dhyana yoga. Dhyana yoga is you stay in that state. You stay in that state. So it's interesting, I learned how to do this kind of thing as a way to get free of pain and labor in childbirth. And I found that I could do it, but I thought, wow, I really wouldn't want to try to stay in this state all the time. You know, again, then you're not working in the world. You know, if you're in such a deep trance that you're unaware of your surroundings, how are you going to drive a car like that? You can't. Yeah, it's impossible. You know, and the people who enter into that, they don't move. If somebody goes into a deep state of meditative trance, they're not moving. They're certainly not driving cars and working for banks and, you know, working for the government and trying to raise a family. They're not doing that kind of thing. Practically speaking, they're hardly even breathing. The people who do dhyana yoga, they're barely breathing. Their heart is barely beating. They've slowed down their breathing, they've slowed down their metabolism, they've slowed down their heartbeat. And we have instances, right, of yogis that are only eating like once every 10 days a piece of fruit. So who's going to be able to do this? And just some practice that says, okay, do some sort of meditation for 15 minutes a day or even an hour a day. I mean, I'm sure it will help somebody's health and etc. But it's not really going to bring one to the perfectional stage, because it's not the real dhyana yoga. Now, all of those, with not quite as much dhyana yoga, but all of them are trying to empty the cup. And they're all very difficult. They all require a lot of qualification, a lot of determination, a lot of willpower. They may require some separation from society. And they require us to do something which ultimately is not natural. Therefore, Krishna says in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Klesho dikatarastesham, avyakta shakti chetasam, avyakta hi vityur dukam, deha vadbir avapyutam. He said these sort of processes, they work, they're bona fide, they're real processes. They can achieve the result of full enlightenment and freedom from all bad habits and all bad qualities, but they are extremely difficult and troublesome. Some people prefer them. But in general, they are troublesome processes. So bhakti yoga certainly also requires some work. It certainly also requires some determination. It requires to be somewhat different than the outside materialistic society. It's not that there's no difficulty. Like we were coming here, we were talking about in the car, the ease of modern society. How fast and easy everything is. You know, like I have a electronic book reader, because as I travel the world, I can't travel with my library. I used to have a 4,000 book library. I really like books. But that would be a little hard to travel with 4,000 books. a little difficult. So, you know, I have one of these electronic book readers, and it's so amazing. You know, you just, if you want to buy a book, you just go online and you have all your information already there in the system. So you just find the book you want to buy and you click one button, and literally within 3 to 5 seconds, that book is on your reader, if any of you have those. You know, it's something like mystic power. There's a mystic power called Prapti City where you just like, you know, okay, I want a mango, I want a mango. So it's something like that. You know, you just say, you know, I want that book, I want that book. There it is, you know. And we're very used to this idea in modern society that everything is instant. You know, it's really instant. Someone says, oh, I just sent you an email. I didn't get it yet. You know. So we definitely have a difficulty in modern society with the concept that something takes some work, that something takes some effort, and that it may take some time to fruition. Most of us don't grow our own food. You know, when people lived in a society where they grew their own food, they understood that, you know, you have to prepare the soil, and you have to clean and sort the seeds, and you have to plant the seeds, and you have to fertilize the land, and you have to weed the soil, and you have to, you know, and it's a process, and then you get your food. Whereas to us, again, you want food, you just walk out your door and take 10 steps and go to a shop and just buy it, right? And it's just there. But if one wants to achieve something, if one wants to achieve the attainment of our real personality, which is truly wonderful, it does take some work. It's not generally instantaneous. But Bhakti Yoga, although it takes some work, it takes some effort, it doesn't have this emptiness of the other processes. So the basic way Bhakti Yoga works is something like this. Okay, I have my cup full of chemical juice. And I want to put in real juice. I don't want an empty cup. I want to put in real juice, and I don't ever want to have an empty cup at any time. I don't want to have to just give things up. I don't want to just have to give up the fruits of my work. I don't want to just have to think about all the negative side of life, how life is so temporary, and life is so miserable, and life is so awful, and life is so awful, and life is so awful. And nor do I want to go to the forest and just, you know, live on roots and berries. So I don't want to do that. I want my cup always to be full, but I want to go from chemical juice to real fruit juice. So how could I go from chemical juice to real fruit juice and never have an empty cup?
You fill up the cup with the pure juice, which will force the concentrated juice out of the cup.
Okay, very good. So I just, while I have the chemical juice in my cup, it's already in my cup, I start taking the real juice and I start pouring it in. So what will happen as I do that is I'm going to have a mix. That if I keep pouring in the pure juice and I never pour any chemical juice, the mix will gradually get purer and purer and purer until it's completely pure. So that is the process of Bhakti Yoga. And because you always have a full cup with Bhakti Yoga, even though there's some work and it's not instantaneous, still, it's what we call Keval Ananda Kanda. It's always happy. It's always happy because one always has a full cup. Okay? So it's not trying to empty your cup. It's not trying to just get rid of the bad qualities, but it's trying to replace those bad qualities with the real qualities of the self. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay? So how are we going to do that in Bhakti Yoga? Now, the main way that we do this in Bhakti Yoga is by focusing on who we really are. Because who we really are is wonderful. Why is it that we all have this urge to be a perfect person? Where does it come from? I mean, if it's practically speaking impossible materially just by moving through the modes, why do we even want it? Why do we expect ourselves and the other people we interact with to be this idealized epitome of a person? Why do we expect someone to be the perfect mother, the perfect sister, the perfect brother, the perfect employee, and we expect that of ourselves? It must exist, actually. Otherwise, where would the desire come from? You know, the modern philosophy that we are simply material and that we are simply the result of many, many cosmic accidents and mutations over billions of years without any kind of purpose would not lead us to yearn for perfection. It just wouldn't. We have no inclination for it at all. In fact, it seems like if that were the true philosophy of life, we would yearn for mistakes. According to that philosophy, the only reason there's any life on the planet or any planet at all or human beings is because there's lots and lots of mistakes and some of them end up to work out right. So why would we want perfection? Where would the urge come from if all we were was matter? It means that it must actually be there in reality. Our idea of, you know, this is my perfect self, that idea exists because I am a perfect self. My self as a perfect being, in fact, already exists. It's not even something one has to become. I mean, think another problem with the material methods of moving up through the modes is it gives one the impression that one has to become a different kind of person, that one has to develop qualities that aren't already there, or change one's nature, or change one's personality. But in Bhakti Yoga, we say, well, you are already perfect. You don't have to do anything to become perfect at all. It's already there. It already exists. It's something like if your father or mother left you a big inheritance, and it's already there in the bank. It already exists. You don't have to do anything to earn an inheritance, yes? I mean, all you have to do is live. You just have to live to claim it. I mean, you can do things to mess up getting the inheritance, but generally, if you just stay alive, you'll automatically get your inheritance. And it's already there. You just have to claim it. So who we are is already there. It is really a question just on focusing on who we are rather than who we aren't. Of course, then the question comes up, well, why am I in this predicament in the first place? Why am I in a predicament where I'm acting as somebody that I'm not? And I'm acting as if I have bad qualities that I don't already have? And the answer to that never pleases anybody. Nobody ever likes the answer to this question. And people argue about it quite a lot. And the reason that we're in this predicament is because we're foolish. And there just isn't any other answer. And people really struggle with that. Well, how could I be that foolish? Why would I be that foolish? I don't think I would be that foolish. But that's just the beginning, middle, and end of it. It's like asking the question, why do people smoke? There isn't any reasonable answer to that question. It's not that people sit down and make a logical decision, well, I really think it'll be good for me, you know. It's just foolish. And there's nothing else beyond the fact that it's foolish. And somebody's thinking, I'm going to become happy, I'm going to become peaceful, I'm going to get some enjoyment by putting this toxic substance into my body. Even though there's all evidence to the contrary. And because we have free will, we are able to do things that are foolish. And that's just it. There's nothing beyond that. It's not more complicated than that. It's not more esoteric than that. That's all it is. That we, as pure spiritual beings, that we somehow or other had some desire, let me try to be something that I'm not. Let me see what it's like to be something that I'm not. And again, that's if you think, well, that's dumb, the answer is yes, it's dumb. There's no logic to it at all. And part of advancing in Bhakti Yoga is seeing that's dumb. We generally refer to that as humility. Humility does not mean, oh, I'm so bad and I'm so awful. That's not what humility means. Humility means, oh, wow, I'm really foolish to try to be something that I wasn't. And to take on these bad qualities when I'm a perfect soul. And that may sound pretty simple, but for a materialistic person, saying that and believing it and acting on that is extremely difficult. Remember we talked about how people in the mode of ignorance, they get angry if you tell them they forgot to put paper in the copy machine. So what to speak of if you have to face the fact that on an existential, spiritual, total cosmic level, that we are doing something that is the most foolish thing we could possibly be doing. So it's not something that most people want to face. But it really isn't such a big deal, frankly. I mean, frankly, if you could just kind of get over that and face it. Now, Bhakti Yoga will become very, very easy. And if one is not willing to face that, Bhakti Yoga is quite difficult. So this is our real situation, that we are already perfect beings who are simply making a foolish choice to try to pretend to be something that we're not. So the process of bhakti yoga is so, 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 so simple. You just simply start acting as who you really are. That's all it is. You stop acting as who you're not, and you start acting as who you are. And usually that's gradual. Just like we're pouring the real fruit juice into the cup. So usually at first, the main thing there is our false identity with a little bit of our real identity. And gradually, 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 we're acting more according to our real identity. And as we act more and more according to our real identity, our good qualities naturally manifest and our bad qualities naturally go away with very little effort on our part. Now, when we saw this little story here, we can think about, he has always the problems, temperature and noise. We have a little bit of an idea of the internal. I'm going to do something a little different. We're going to look first at the internal process of how this works, and then we're going to look externally. And the reason I'm going to do that in reverse order is because I think if we look at the externals first, then a lot of people think that the process of bhakti yoga is a question of just certain external behaviors with the body. And then they see bhakti yoga as, okay, something mechanical. If I just do this, do this, do this, do this, if I just tick off these boxes, then I'll attain enlightenment. Or they look at bhakti yoga as some kind of a religion that has its particular rituals. You know, and depending on who you are, you might find that very attractive or very unattractive. So if it happens to be your birth religion, you might find it attractive, and if it doesn't happen to be your birth religion, you might find that unattractive. So people can look at bhakti yoga and say, okay, it's a particular religion. And in this particular religion, you know, you wear this kind of clothes and you eat this kind of food and you say these kind of prayers and you say them like this and you sit like this and you do this, this and you take off all these and then you go to heaven and like that. So if we look at the externals first, I see that we have these problems that people tend to think it's something mechanical or people tend to think it's some kind of religious ritual. So let's look first at what's the internal way that we do this. So the internal way that we more and more act as who we are and fill our cup with the real fruit juice and really come to pure goodness is that we get close to our source. We get as close as possible to our source, who's Krishna, who is the sum total of pure goodness and of whom we are a part. Not a part as one word, but a part, two words. So the reason that we're perfect is that we are part of the perfect. We're not part of the perfect in the sense that little pieces, all of which together make up the whole. We're part of the perfect more in the sense that a child is part of the parents. The child is a separate individual, the parents are separate individuals. But still, you can say the child is part of the parents. The child has the parents' DNA and so forth. So we're part of Krishna, something like that. I mean, it's hard to give an analogy because it's on a different platform. But we get close to Krishna. The closer we get to Krishna and the more focused we are in getting close to Krishna, the more effective what we're doing is going to be. So to find out who I am and to be who I am and get rid of who I'm not, I come close to my source. Now when I come close to Krishna, because Krishna is pure goodness and Krishna is all knowledge, then what happens is everything becomes revealed to me. I see everything clearly. Now anyone who comes to material goodness will also see clearly to a large extent. But as we said, trying to come to material goodness just by changing one's modes is extremely difficult. When you get close to Krishna, coming to pure goodness is very easy. Because as soon as you're next to Krishna, immediately you're in goodness. And what's interesting is even if you're generally in ignorance, if you come close to Krishna just for 5 minutes, for that 5 minutes, you're going to be in goodness. It's something like you turn on the light in your room. Even if you only turn it on for 5 minutes, for that 5 minutes, your room is lit up. And because Krishna is not material goodness, coming close to Krishna is not dependent on time of day or place or one's astrology or one's nature or one's body or whatever, because it's not material mode of goodness. It's above that. It's completely spiritual. So therefore, one can come close to Krishna at any time and in any circumstance without much endeavor. Why without much endeavor? Because Krishna's everywhere. You don't have to get on a plane and, you know, save up 1,000 quid or whatever, you know, to go to a holy place to get close to Krishna. You don't even have to, and I hope I don't get in trouble for this, but you don't even have to come here. Because Krishna's everywhere. Ishvara Sarvabhutanam Hridayeshu Janatishtati. He's within our own body. So it's not possible, in fact, to be far away from him. He's in every atom. Ekopisora chaitam jagananda koti at shaktirasti jagananda chayayanta andantarasta paramanu chantarastam. He's in every atom. He's in our heart. He's everywhere. Everything is made of his energy. Vumala panayovayu kamano buddhareva cha. So you don't really have, you don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to do some special ritual even to get close to Krishna. All you have to do to get close to Krishna is to want to get close to Krishna, frankly. The purpose of the center, the purpose of everything that we do, according to Bhagavad Gita 12.9, is simply to help us to want to get close to Krishna. Or if you're already close to Krishna, to express the happiness you feel at being close to Krishna. Something like, if you give someone you love flowers, that can either be to establish the relationship or to express an already existing relationship or some combination of the two. So everything that we do is the reason we have the center and the reason we have our food and our chanting and our books and all these kind of things is simply to help somebody get a desire to be close to Krishna. That is its purpose. That is its function. But as soon as one has a desire to be close to Krishna, because he has a desire to be close to us. Actually, my guru, Srila Prabhupada, explained that Krishna has 10 times more desire to be close to us than we have to be close to him. So because he has a desire to be close to us, as soon as we have a desire to be close to him, it happens. Because it's something that he wants also. It's not like sometimes in relationships where you want to be friends with someone, but they don't want to be friends with you. Right, you have to kind of negotiate it. And maybe sometimes it just doesn't work at all. But Krishna's already quite clear. I want to be close to you. I want you to be who you are. So as soon as we get close to Krishna, everything is revealed. Jnana Dipena Bhashvata. We see everything clearly. Remember how in the mode of ignorance, a person doesn't see anything clearly at all? And the mode of passion, they kind of do the right thing, but they barely see themselves clearly. And the mode of goodness, you can see clearly. But when you're close to Krishna, you really see things clearly. Now, ironically, as soon as this happens, some people get scared from bhakti yoga. Many times when people get close to Krishna and they start to see the truth, they run away again. Many times. Quite common. Because part of what you'll see in the truth is how foolish we are. That's part of what you'll see when you see the truth. You'll see, I'm great, I'm perfect, I'm a part of God, I'm a spiritual being, I already am the ideal person that I would like to be. Everything I would like to be, everything I'm working for, I already am, I already have, it already exists. All I have to do is claim it. And then you look at the difference between that fact and what you're actually doing. And it's a little, how should we put, embarrassing. It's a little embarrassing. Of course, this isn't just embarrassing to ourselves. So many people, when they see this truth, they hide from it. They run away again. You know, oh, I thought bhakti yoga would be like ordering a book to put on my e-reader. I just press a button and my enlightenment is there. But enlightenment means, my dear friends, making a choice. Ultimately, that's what it comes down to, making a choice to be enlightened. And that isn't as simple as saying, well, I want to be enlightened. But so then you see the reality. You see how wonderful the truth is, how wonderful Krishna is, how wonderful we are. And in contrast, one sees the depth of foolishness of our choice to be something that we're not. How we are choosing our bad qualities, which is the ultimate reason why it's so hard to give them up. Which is the ultimate reason why, even if we work really, really hard to make a change and we think we've made it, we may then end up, whoops. Oops. And why, when one just stays in the modes, one keeps getting affected by passion and ignorance? Because on a deep level, we want that. Which is, again, nothing short of total idiocy. But when one comes to Krishna and comes close to Krishna, one sees that. One sees, I am choosing to be somebody less than what I really am. I am choosing these bad qualities. I am choosing the very things I say that I want to give up. I am choosing the very things that I say I want to purify. And that's why I have them. Because nitya nityanam chaitanya chaitanyam eka bhavanam yogadadati kaman. That Krishna is giving us whatever we want. And if we want something foolish, ultimately he'll give it to us. Not easily. If we want spiritual things, we get them relatively easily. So one sees that. Now, although that's embarrassing, undoubtedly it's embarrassing. There's no question that it's embarrassing and somewhat painful. It's also liberating. Because if all this is happening due to my choice, then who has the power? I do. Bhakti yoga is the ultimate end to victimization. It's the ultimate end to victimization. There's no victimization. Now, as long as I want material things, I'm a puppet of the modes by my own choice. And I do feel like a victim because the modes are directing my activities. I'm putting myself under them, and therefore they're directing my activities. But once I see that I'm putting myself under the modes, something like a person who chooses to drink alcohol and then alcohol pushes them to do things against what they really want to do. You know, they come out of the alcohol and then, oh my God, what did I just do? Right? But the person drank by choice. So we do feel like victims when we're a materialistic consciousness. But in Bhakti Yoga, you see, I don't have to be a victim. The agency is with me. I can choose. And when one looks at this difference between illusion and reality, the wonder, the glory of Krishna and the wonder and glory of the soul, and the foolishness and the silliness, just silly, of materialistic choices and making a choice to be something that we're not. And then we really say from the depth of our heart, I choose truth. All right, now, here's another little funny thing that happens. When one chooses truth, one doesn't know the results of that choice ahead of time. So many people will say, okay, I see this, and I would choose truth if I knew what the consequences would be. It doesn't work like that. In fact, that's not possible. It's actually impossible. Because as long as one is covered with illusion, one can't possibly see. Make sense? It's like I'll take the bag off my head when I can see what it looks like without the bag. You just can't. It's simply impossible. So therefore, every religion, every spiritual path talks about something called faith. Because at that moment of choice, one is saying, I don't know. I kind of know what the result of choosing illusion is. I kind of know what the result of choosing to be something that I'm not and a false self is because I've been experiencing that. And I know I don't like it, but it's sort of, I'm used to it. But I don't know what will happen when I choose truth. You know, maybe when I choose truth, I'll just leave everything in the world and go move into a Hare Krishna ashram and my parents will get angry. And maybe I won't care about taking care of my family anymore. Maybe I'll quit my job. Maybe I'll just leave everything and go to India. And maybe I'll start dancing on the street with drums and cymbals and people will make fun of me. You know, what funny thing will I do? What will happen to me? I don't know. Will I become irresponsible in the material sense? Will I lose my intelligence in the material sense? What will be the consequences? And you don't know. So the way I understand that it works is one is seeing, okay, here's the beauty of truth. Here's the beauty of who I am. There I'm seeing at least a little bit of the person that I really am and the person I keep trying to be and failing. And I see that that's already there. And I get some idea at least of how wonderful Krishna is, how wonderful the total truth is. And I also really see that how incredibly silly and foolish I am for choosing something that's false. And I see the real nature of the false thing. Srila Prabhupada calls it the naked form. You see the naked form of material desires. You see what they really are. And I'll tell you, they're nasty. But I have this fear. I have this fear that if I choose truth, if I choose who I really am, and I let go of the other stuff, well, what kind of fears do I have? I have a fear that it'll be really hard, like trying to change myself by going through the modes, that it will be, you know, a really difficult experience like that. I may have a fear that I'll work really hard and that it won't stick, like I've had with my material experiences. I may have a fear that I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to choose truth and give up falsity. What are the steps? What do I have to do? It just seems really, really hard. This thing I'm seeing in my heart is so nasty and so evil, and I'll never be able to get it out. Or we may think, you know, maybe something terrible will happen. Maybe I'll, you know, make some foolish choices. I'll lose something in the world. And these fears keep us so that even though we see the reality, we don't make the proper choice. So what has to happen is that when one gets close to Krishna, one's attraction for Krishna and or one's disgust with falsity have to be so strong that they overcome the fear. That one then gets courage and says, you know, I don't care. Just like I read a story about this woman whose husband had a heart attack suddenly when he was fairly young, late 40s, early 50s, and, you know, she's going with him to the hospital, and the doctor comes up to her and says, it's really bad. Does he have a do not resuscitate order? And she says, no, do whatever you can. Now, a friend of mine, her husband got sick with cancer when he was like 30, a really rare kind of cancer. And he was telling me what kind of treatment he had to go through to get well. I mean, he had to be in an isolation booth because his immune system was so compromised. You know, they had to replace all of his bone marrow. I mean, all these incredibly, incredibly painful, difficult therapies over so long. But a person then is saying, I will do anything. If you've ever thought about a circumstance you've been in where you thought, I would do anything. I just talked to a friend of mine who's sick and said to me, I would give anything to get better. I don't care what the cost is. Doesn't matter. So that is the kind of attitude that one has to have. That this evil, this falsity, this foolishness is so awful. And my attraction to the truth and to Krishna is so great that I don't care what the price is. I just don't care. Maybe all of these fears are true. Maybe it will be too hard. Maybe it won't stay. Maybe I will end up doing something foolish. Maybe I will lose everything. Maybe nobody will love me anymore. Maybe me. I don't care. I want truth. I choose truth. And then what happens is, poof, the negative stuff is gone instantly and immediately with no effort on our part at all. Nothing. Because Krishna is responding to desire. So when we have that desire, poof, it's gone. And it's gone, gone, gone. It's gone, 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 gone. And it's just gone. I mean, if you really wanted it back, you could say, please, can I have it back? But otherwise, it's just gone. And then you say, wow, that was nice. And then again you get close to Krishna. Because generally, one is not going to pull out the whole thing the first time. That's possible. Srila Prabhupada said it's possible to become Krishna conscious in a moment. So it's possible that one could see the whole root of the whole problem and then want that to be gone immediately and the whole thing gone immediately. But generally that's a bit too much for most of us. Generally our fears are going to be too great to do that. So if you think of it that this attachment to the false self and attachment to illusion and attachment to things that give our bad qualities or something like a big tree, Krishna compares it to a big tree. And that what happens is that different branches get cut off and eventually the tree gets so weak there's not that much left to it and then you can take out the whole thing. This is nicely explained in the fourth canto of the Bhagavatam. So it mostly seems to work like that. You get close to Krishna, then you get revealed the truth. Here's how wonderful Krishna is, here's how wonderful you really are, and this is the foolishness you're doing. Generally, it's a particular foolishness. As I said, it's generally not the whole thing. And then you want Krishna badly enough and you hate illusion badly enough that you just don't care what the price is. And you honestly say, I choose truth. That I choose truth is very mixed with the idea that I have been choosing untruth. Is that clear to everybody? You cannot say I choose truth unless you admit I've been choosing untruth. So that ability to see that this is my choice, I am not a victim. I have been choosing this false thing, I have been choosing this to be this kind of a person, and now I no longer want that. Whatever the price may be, I choose to be the other. And then it's gone. And then again, more is revealed, and more is gone, and more is gone, and more is gone. Until it gets to the point that the cup is almost totally full of real juice. Now, what Srila Prabhupada says is when you're halfway there, when you've gotten rid of half of your artificial stuff, and you're halfway who you really are, then everything becomes very easy. So until you get to that halfway point, it's a little difficult. Because the attachments are so many and so strong and it seems so overwhelming. But once half of them are gone, think of it like if you're scrubbing a dirty pot that really got burnt, you know? And when it's all black at the bottom, it's kind of discouraging. But once you can see, you know, at least half the silver at the bottom, it's not so hard anymore. You feel very, oh, look, there's actually a pot under there, you know? And you feel very encouraged. So once about half of the difficulties are gone, then one starts seeing one's real self, not just in a general way, as a perfect, wonderful, spiritual person, but one starts seeing the specifics of one's spiritual identity. One starts seeing the specifics of one's spiritual personality, the specifics of one's spiritual form, and one starts understanding the specifics of our relationship with Krishna. So that's the internal process of bhakti yoga. You can understand, once one starts seeing the specifics of one's identity, then everything gets very exciting. You know, and then there's no problem at all with wanting to see is this whole angst of, do I really want to see the dirt in my heart? That becomes, practically speaking, irrelevant. It's something like you see the finish line and you're just running the end of the race and you don't even notice any of the obstacles anymore. They become very, very easy. So that's the internal process of bhakti, and then the external process is really what to do to get close to Krishna. So that's chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, which, you know, chanting individually on beads for meditation, chanting in group as kirtan, reading about Krishna, talking about Krishna, which is reading the scriptures like Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, having friends who are also on the spiritual path. That's very important, very helpful, right? If you're only with people who are materialistic, it's really hard to maintain one's enthusiasm and one's desire, right? Going to holy places like this temple, right? And doing some regular worship, offering one's food and so forth. And then negative, right? Giving up meat, fish, eggs, intoxication, illicit sex, gambling. That's the basic principles of bhakti yoga. So even the external practices are not that difficult. Although, certainly, if you get into it, you can find that there becomes a lot of picky little rules here and there. But that's the basic part of how to practice bhakti yoga. And one who practices bhakti yoga finds that they actually become full of good qualities without having to make a separate endeavor to do so. Now, does that mean that one should never make a separate endeavor to do so? One can do that. Certainly one can also use techniques that are helping one to rise through the modes, and one can also even use techniques from karma yoga and jnana yoga and dhyana yoga. It's not that those things are absolutely forbidden. They may be helpful, but that's not what's really doing the job. What's really doing the job is that one sees who one really is, and one gets attracted to that and says, that's what I want. I want the truth, and I don't want the false self. And when we come to the point that we only want to be who we really are, whatever the price, and by the way, there really isn't any price. There really isn't any price. But when one comes to that point, then it is fully there. And how fast or how slow one goes is also very much in our own hands. So there you go. Now, the principle, the practice is not difficult. The concept is not difficult. However, it often tends to be difficult because we say we want something and we really want something else. That is the problem. That is the essence of the problem as to why people may find bhakti yoga difficult. We say, I want to become enlightened, I want to become the perfect person, I want to give up acting in ways that are against my ideal, but we don't really. It's almost like we want to continue acting in wrong ways but not suffer for it. And what we're really asking is, can I not get the bad reaction for what I'm doing but keep on doing it? Which is quite a different thing. You know, it's something like, can I eat a lot and not gain weight? I think there's a whole industry catering to that. Calorie-less food, right? Food that has no calories. Have no taste, yeah. Well, it has some sort of a taste. Doesn't have a very satisfying taste, but has some sort of a taste. So, because that's often what we're really saying to Krishna. What we're really saying to Krishna is, I want to go on being selfish, and I want to go on being cruel, and I want to go on being irresponsible, and I want to go on being negligent, and I want to go on doing all these things and being all these things, but I just don't want to suffer for it. When I insult you and I offend you, you know, I don't want you to get mad at me. And that doesn't work. And if we're thinking like that, then bhakti yoga will be very difficult and take a very, very long time. Because then every time we're confronted with the truth, we won't want to see it. Oops. We won't want to... This is quite a gizmo here. It looks like... That's all right. It looks like some alien... spacecraft. I also find it fascinating about how people try to make it a lot more complicated than it is. You know, try to think you have to do other things. I mean, you can move up through the modes, you can use stuff from karma yoga, you can use stuff from jnana yoga and dhyana yoga. But if people think they have to, I have to add something from jnana yoga, I have to add something from jnana yoga, I have to move up through the modes of nature, or I can't do it because I can't do this process because I need to become advanced first and then I can do it. Which always amuses me. So many reasons why to make it more difficult or more complicated than it is. Get close to Krishna, which means do the activities of bhakti with a desire to get close to Krishna. Not do them superficially, not do them ritualistically. So if you're chanting just ritualistically, you're not going to get very close to Krishna. A little bit. How much? But to really, this is what we talk about. We use the word attentive. attentive chanting, attentive hearing. That's a word you hear a lot in the Hare Krishna movement, to be attentive. So when we talk about getting close to Krishna, remember he's already there? You all remember that? Okay. So how do you get close to Krishna? You just start paying attention to what's already there, really. Therefore, everything done with attention. So getting close to Krishna, then Krishna, he does the next job. He reveals. You don't have to do that. He does that. You don't have to try to see the truth. You just have to try to get close to Krishna. He reveals the truth. Then accept it. Look at it. Wow. I am choosing this. I am a fool. Aha. Because I'm actually a wonderful soul. I am a spiritual being. I am wonderful. And I am choosing this because I'm a fool. Ah! This is terrible, this thing I'm choosing. How can I be choosing this? Oh, that's terrible. I want the real thing. I choose reality. I don't care what the price is. I choose it. I choose it. I choose it. I don't want to suffer anymore. I don't want to be a fool anymore. I choose reality. Oh, it's gone. Wow. That's it. That's it. That's it. And then as it's gone, you see Krishna more, you see yourself more, and then it starts becoming, wow, look at Krishna. Look at Krishna. Wow, look at Krishna. I want Krishna. I want Krishna. I want Krishna. You have to get rid of this. Oh, fine. Sure, whatever. Okay. Let's see. You've got to get rid of that. Oh, sure, fine, whatever. You got to do this. Oh, sure, fine. I'll take that. Sure. Okay. You know. And it becomes like that. So Bhakti Yoga is so nice. You don't have to leave society. You don't have to go to the mountains. You don't have to just sit around studying. You know, you don't have to hang out in like old age homes and cemeteries. Anybody can do it because Krishna is everywhere. Krishna is everywhere. And he's in everything. So Krishna consciousness is available to anyone. And it doesn't make any difference how educated you are, how smart you are, how healthy you are, how tall you are, how short you are, how much melanin you have in your skin. None of those things make any difference because Krishna is everywhere. One doesn't need any particular type of material qualification. All one needs is the desire. All one needs is the desire. And all of our process is meant to bring out that desire and get the desire stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. So, questions, comments? Yes?
I was just wondering about our nature. So, sometimes I find personally that I have a certain type of nature, and if that nature is not utilized properly from the morning till night, then my mind will get distracted. I'll feel less satisfied, even though I'm performing Krishna consciousness.
Okay, so I'm going to repeat what you said to everybody. So he's saying that he finds he has a nature, and if he's not using that nature properly from morning to night, then he'll have difficulty in Krishna consciousness. Yes.
So I'm just wondering if you could give some pointers about how to actually find our nature so we can most optimally use our energy for Krishna.
How can we find our nature so we can most optimally use our energy for Krishna? We have two natures. One is our eternal spiritual nature, and the other is our current nature in this body. Like I was saying, each body is a particular combination of the modes. This is according to our past karma and our past desires. Each of us have a mind and body that's a particular combination of the modes. And it's helpful to find out what that is so we can work with it. And what we do is we use the nature of this body and this mind in such a way that it brings us closer to Krishna rather than away from Krishna. But we don't try to imitate someone else's nature. You know, it is possible, as we said, to change your nature and move up through the modes, but it's extremely difficult. And generally in one life it isn't done completely. So how does one find what one's nature is? You see what makes you feel alive. It's kind of like figuring out what are the best foods for you. You know, in modern society, they have an idea that the best foods are the best foods for everybody. You know, that there's one diet that's like ideal for everybody. But Ayurveda is not like that. Ayurveda says there's different bodily types, and one man's food is another man's poison. You know, for one person, potatoes are great food, and another person, potatoes are a terrible food. So the kind of food that's right for you is the kind of food that makes you feel alive. Just like we eat certain kinds of food and we feel energized. And we feel healthy and we eat other kinds of foods and we want to go to sleep. And we're draggy and our stomach bloats out, yes? So just like there are certain foods that resonate with our particular bodily constitution, there are certain activities that resonate with our particular psychological constitution. So there's certain ways of acting that will make you feel alive and certain ways of acting that will make you feel like, well. So you think about what kind of things do I do where I don't want to stop. You know, I don't care about meals, I don't care about going to sleep. I wish I could just keep doing them. And what kind of things are just the opposite? What kind of things I do where I'm always looking at the clock and it's taking forever and I keep distracting myself. You know, I have something to do and it should take an hour and it takes 10 hours because I keep interrupting it because I don't like it. So this gives us a good idea of what our nature is. And that's a rather complicated question that would take a lot more than a 5-minute answer. But that's the basic answer. And then the way you use that to come close to Krishna is you use it in such a way that will advance yourself spiritually. And the simple, simple answer for that is that you see what you enjoy and then you offer that to Krishna. So if what you enjoy, you know, according to Varna, there's four basic things that everyone enjoys playing with. Do you enjoy playing with knowledge and ideas? Do you enjoy playing with caring for people? Is that your play? Do you enjoy generating wealth and natural resources and animals? Or do you enjoy the arts and the crafts and beauty and functionality in society? What is your area of enjoyment? And then you say, all right, I'm going to take that area that I enjoy that makes me feel alive, and I'm going to use that to glorify Krishna. I'm going to use that to bring out truth.
What do you mean, functionality in society?
Functionality? The Shudra Varna deals with beauty and functionality. Chairs.
Okay.
Clothes. Cars. So what Shudras do in society is they allow society to function. Without Shudras, there's no functioning and there's no beauty. That makes sense? So if you like to create beauty and functionality in society, then you say, okay, that's my area, as an example. How can I create beauty in such a way that it will bring people closer to Krishna? How can I create, just like, you know, these chairs are made in a factory. I mean, we can sit on them for this discussion and they can bring us closer to Krishna in that way. But suppose the chairs were made by hand with great craftsmanship and the artistry of the chair inspired one spiritually. So people who are inclined to enjoy creating functionality should do so in such a way that elevates themselves and others spiritually. So whatever it is that you enjoy doing, you do it in such a way that brings yourself and others closer to spirituality. So that's a whole science of, you know, how to do that. Specifically, how to do that.
Thank you.
Is that good enough?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't want to, you know, that would be like an hour discussion.
Yeah.
Yes.
If you choose to go all the way to Krishna,
yes,
you're making this choice, and your parents, your mom in particular, is suffering this person, and it's been. So is that the fair price to pay
for? Sometimes. In fact, one of the first prices that anybody pays for spirituality generally is some difficulty in relationships. You know, Rupa Goswami gives the steps in attaining enlightenment. The first is called anushraddha, or some beginning faith. The second is called sadhu sangha. Sangha means your association. And the way I think of it is, beginning faith, you haven't taken the spiritual path. You're just admitting that there is one. That's just kind of people who say, yes, I believe in God, I believe in your spirituality, I believe there's more to life. What are you doing? Nothing. You know, their lives have very little spirituality in it. But they say, yes, I believe in it. So that's better than someone who says we're just a bunch of machines. And then the next step, sadhu sangha, you're not really on the spiritual path, but you've turned. You've started to change your friends. And usually, this is just adding. usually you start adding friends who are interested in spirituality. And generally what happens is some of your old associates drop you. That's usually the way it works. Sometimes you drop them, but usually they drop you. Usually they come to you and they say, you know, if you don't want to go out to the pubs anymore, then I really have nothing in common with you. And I guess we're just not going to see each other anymore. Now, sometimes it becomes very difficult because that person is in some intimate relationship with you. They're your mother, or they're your husband, or your wife, or your child, or somebody where neither you or them is going to drop the relationship. Of course, sometimes they do drop the relationship. Sometimes your parents will say, you know, okay, I'm just not going to see you anymore if you're on the spiritual path, or, you know, I'm going to leave you if you're on the spiritual path. It's happened. But sometimes you still are in association with them, but they're really in a lot of pain. I mean, in my own life, when I decided I was really going to be serious about Krishna consciousness, my father was immediately supportive. He said, I'm so glad you're looking for God. I wish you would do it in our own religion, but that's not what's important. What's important is you're looking for God, and I completely support you. And my mother went nuts. Just nuts. She acted like I had, you know, given up my American citizenship and become a Russian. That was really how she saw it. She thought that, you know, you've taken sides with the enemy. You're neglecting your people. You're neglecting your culture. You're turning your back on your family. I mean, it was... And any time that she would deal with me, for 8 years, it was very stressful. I remember when she visited us, and at one point my husband said to her, you know, I don't know if you really should come to our home. And she said, why? She said, because you just want your daughter to leave this movement and leave her husband and leave her son. And she looked at me and she said, well, I never want her to leave her son. So it was tense. It was really tense for 8 years. And you want to change it after 8 years? We were visiting her, and she was watching the news on television, and we didn't leave the room. We stayed and watched the news on television with her. After that, she decided that we were reasonably normal. And she changed her mentality. And then I remember we had our own house, and we had a car, and, you know, and that was a lot easier for her than when I was living in an ashram selling books on the underground. You know, my mother could not deal with that. She just couldn't deal with that. You know, how's your daughter doing? Oh, she lives in a closet in a Hindu ashram, and she's selling books on the underground. I mean, she just couldn't make the words come out of her mouth to tell her friends and her family. And it was very... I think that was the main difficulty for her. And once she could say, oh, you know, she's running a preschool, and her husband's a computer programmer for Ford Motor Company, and they have a house, and then she kind of relaxed. And the other interesting thing that happened to her, she used to say to me all the time, she said, you know, if you want to be fanatically religious, why don't you do it in our own religion? Why do you have to be another religion? And then my sister became fanatically religious in our own religion. And then my mother came to me and said, I'm so happy you're who you are. Because what happens is when you're in the same religion and you're more strict than someone else, there's often more tension than between religions. So when my sister became ultra, ultra, ultra religious, she felt that my mother was a bad influence on her children because my mother wasn't as strict. And it just changed my mother's thinking. She said, I'm really glad for who you are. And then as our children grew up, she started saying to me, you must be doing something right. You have such wonderful children. So that kind of became her mantra. And she gradually, it was very gradual, she gradually became more and more warm and more and more open. And by the time that she died, she and I had become very close. And she actually had a very spiritual death. She had a very spiritual passing. It was wonderful in every respect. But it was a long journey. Now, I also had a lot of the responsibility for the fact that it was such a long, hard journey with her, because I was a very typical convert. And I was very much had the mood of, you know, I'm right and you're wrong, and, you know, if you see me, it's got to be all on my terms. I did not try to meet her halfway. I did not try to be understanding, and I regret that. I mean, I don't think I could have been more mature than I was, but I also had a lot of responsibility for that. So if I had dealt with her in a kinder, more mature manner from the beginning, I don't think it would have been that long. I don't think it would have taken 10 years. You know, it was 8 years of intense negativity and then another 2 years of sort of lukewarm. And then after 10 years, then it was actually quite nice. But generally, there'll be someone or someones in your life where your relationship with them will change or you may lose your relationship with them. And that is generally the first place. Generally. And there are people who turn back at that point. There are definitely people who turn back at that point and say, I'm not going to be willing to pay that price. But when you want to see truth in a world of falsity, you know, for many people, that's very, your existence is very, makes them very uncomfortable. Just the fact that you're saying there's something else and I'm living my life by something else. You know, there's many people who are going to find just that you're taking that stance to be very uncomfortable for them. And then there's other people who are going to feel they have nothing in common with you. Now, I find that if someone's relationship is very valuable to you, you can find areas of commonality. And in fact, when we met Prabhupada in 1974, and my father asked Srila Prabhupada, he said, I'm coming to the temple not to see Krishna, I'm coming to see my daughter and son-in-law, is that okay? And Prabhupada said, yes. He said, they are loving Krishna. He said, chanting and dancing are symptoms of loving Krishna. He said, so they are loving Krishna, and you are loving them, so two things equal to the same thing are equal to each other. But that takes a different mindset, that you think, all right, if I've taken up the spiritual path, that will actually benefit other people who love me, even if they themselves are not on the spiritual path. So I can deal with them on their terms, about their things. I can talk to them about, even though what they're talking about may not interest me anymore, in terms of it may be very superficial things. But I can connect with them on that level, and at a certain point, that if they see that I care about them and I connect with them, then that will also aid them, and eventually we can have a relationship. But some people, it will not be possible. There are some people that it will just not be possible. Yes, it is a rare person who doesn't have to pay this price with at least one person in their life. That is very rare. That you go on the spiritual path and everyone in your life supports you. And everyone in your life connects with you. And everyone in your life is there for you. Then you're very blessed. But that is extremely, extremely rare. So that is generally one of the first prices to pay. Sorry. Yes?
Going along with that, there are two points John's raised. One is, even our culture tends to be obedient to our parents. So you are, in many respects, going to live in them and so on, not obeying them.
Yes.
And even when people get married, I don't know the actual marriage vows, but I'm fairly certain, they don't say, I'll look after you until I go and do my...
spiritual life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you are going back on your vows as well. So.
Well, therefore Krishna says, api chet sucharacharam. You know, Krishna says even if they do something abominable in human society, they're still saintly. So what does that mean? That doesn't mean that, you know, if you go around murdering people, you're still saintly. But yeah, I had to disobey my mother. I didn't disobey my father, but I had to disobey my mother. To take up Krishna consciousness, I had to disobey my mother. There was no question of obeying my mother and taking up Krishna consciousness. I couldn't do both. And Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that austerity in the mode of goodness is respecting superiors like the mother and father. Right? The Bible says honor your mother and father. So that's there. But there's also a way to do it. Like I said, I don't think I did it very nicely. I mean, I tried to according to where I was at the time. I don't want to be too harsh on my 17, 18-year-old self. But, you know, I really didn't do it that well. You follow? I could have done it a lot better. And what I've come to see now is that really the way that we should deal with these things is as secret agents. So if you've ever wanted to be James Bond, that really we work for Krishna's company. We're his employee, we're his agent. And what is he, what is his product?
Prema
Bhakti. Prema Bhakti, love of God. That's his product, is pure love. So that's our real business. Our real business is spreading and selling and distributing love of God, which is had just for the price of somebody wanting it and somebody having faith in it. And these other roles that we play as somebody's daughter, somebody's son, someone's husband, someone's wife, someone's mother, someone's father, someone's employee, as a citizen of a country, and all these other roles we play, which are all called upadis or temporary designations, this is like our cover. You know, if you were going to spy on Russia for the UK government, you can't just go into Russia and say, "Hi, I'm here to spy for Her Majesty's government." You know, you have to have a cover, right? You pretend that you're selling cars or the whatever. So we have, this is our cover. It's not who we really are. I'm not really this person's son and this person's husband and this person's father and this. That's a temporary identity based on this body. It's not who I really am. I'm really a soul. And I really have a business to have spiritual realization. You know, and this is my cover in the world. And then, okay, how do I deal with the people? My real business is selling love of God. So I'm using my position in the family, I'm using my position in society, at work, to try to give everyone love of God. Not as some kind of self-righteous, you know, fanatical, fundamental religionist kind of thing. But actually love of God. So I'm trying to deal with my mother, my father, my son, my daughter, my husband, my wife, my employee, and my employee, so that they and I will advance in love of God. So then I want to figure out, well, where are they in this underground, you know, spy network? Do they also work for Krishna? Are they a co-worker? Maybe they're a supplier of love of God. Maybe they're a customer for love of God. Or maybe they're a potential customer for love of God. Maybe they shop at the illusion store right now, you know. I want to win them over. So then how do you deal with people? How would you deal with a potential customer? By hitting them over the head? I mean, how would you do it? So it's not that you don't take care of your wife anymore, you don't take care of your husband, you don't take care of your mother, you don't take care of your father. But you take care of them in such a way that you're going to be advancing in love with God. You're no longer taking care of them because I am a husband. I mean, even karma yoga is like that. Even karma yoga says, okay, you're not taking care of your wife, so your wife will smile at you and your wife will say, "Oh, my hero," etc. You're not doing it for that anymore. You're taking care of your wife so that you'll become purified. We say you're taking care of your wife so Krishna will smile and you'll just distribute more love of God. That's a very deep and subtle thing. If you're just trying to walk away, then that's not really bhakti yoga. That's really more like gyan yoga or dhyan yoga, where you just walk away from society and you go to the Himalayas and you sit on a cloth and you just eat roots and berries. That's really a different system. Is that okay? And sometimes other people will walk away from you. That will happen sometimes to some people. That other people will say, "I'm sorry, if you're on the spiritual path, I'm out of here. Goodbye." That will happen sometimes. Not generally, but it will happen sometimes. Yes?
I was wondering, I'm quite proactive in terms of you know, trying to get as much as I can in terms of my personal and non-personal spiritual development.
Okay.
You know when you mentioned about coaching and...
So he says he's very proactive in terms of his spiritual development, yes?
Try to be,
okay.
And I was wondering, is that some sense of focusing on myself and trying to control the...
Does that mean that you're focusing on yourself and trying to control it? Usually when you start spiritual life, there's still going to be a focus on yourself. Remember you have the cup and you still have this full of chemical juice and you're pouring in the real juice? So if you read Madhurya Kadambini, in Madhurya Kadambini of Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, he talks about focus on self versus focus on God. And at first, focus on God is just a little trace, and focus on self is absolute. So that just is what it is, what it is, what it is, and just don't worry about it. As you keep focusing more on Krishna, then your percentage in the cup will change. That will just happen naturally. Remember, we're not trying to empty our cup. So you're not trying to get rid of all self-focus and all materialism and have an empty cup. You're trying to just fill it with Krishna. As you fill it with Krishna, then your me consciousness will naturally diminish and diminish and diminish and diminish.
Because like if you put some qualities, for example, of being humble and seeing yourself. And
you don't have to do this by searching with the mind like this and agonizing with the mind like this. That's a different yoga system. That's like more Jnana yoga. You don't have to do that. Well, let's see, am I being more selfish? Am I being more spiritual? Well, maybe the reason I'm doing this is for that reason, and I'm doing this spiritual thing. Maybe I'm doing it for selfish reason. I'm doing this material thing. Maybe I'm doing this over here. Should I be this kind of person? Should I say that? You don't have to do that at all. I mean, you can do it if you want to, but you don't need to do that. And it won't even give you high quality information. Because then you're just relying on your monkey to give you information. And monkeys are not really known for high quality information. So it's just not a very good source. So if you really want to get good information, go to the source. Just get close to Krishna. Ask him to show you. He'll show you. And he's very reliable. And the information he shows you is very reliable. And let him show you what you need to deal with now. You don't have to figure that out yourself. All you have to figure out is, how do I get close to Krishna now? Not how am I going to plan to get close to Krishna tomorrow. Okay? Well, right now I'm not close to Krishna, but after I go to the temple, then I'll be close to Krishna. How do I get close to Krishna now? What do I do now to get close to Krishna? Then Krishna takes care of the next step, which is showing you, okay, this is what you need to do now. He shows you the truth. You'll see. This is something I should be doing that I'm not doing, or something I shouldn't be doing that I am doing. He'll show you what is truth and what is illusion. He's really good at it, and he wants to show it to you. You know, he just kind of wants you to be paying attention. So he'll show you that. And then it will become very obvious. Prabhupada says our duties will become self-evident. Everything just becomes completely clear. And then you say, okay, I choose truth, whatever the consequence. It won't be like that. It'll be, okay, I choose truth. It'll be more like that. So, you know, then you choose truth, whatever the consequences, and then the thing becomes clear, and then immediately you see what you have to do. And then you get close to Krishna. If you keep doing that, everything goes very, 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 very quickly. And that's all you have to do. You don't need to... you just can't trust the monkey anyway. It's not trustworthy. Not trustworthy. The mind... The mind is actually an instrument designed to make us unaware that we are right near Krishna at every moment. The mind is an instrument designed to cloud our awareness that Krishna is already there. That's kind of its function. It can also be used to be aware of Krishna, but the way it mostly functions for us is to obscure our knowledge that Krishna is there. So it'll give you bad information. If really you should be working on this, it'll tell you to work on that. It's not reliable. It's just a machine. The mind's just a machine. And it has a particular combination of modes, and it's... Once you get to a certain point of purification, then you can, you know, you're using your mind to meditate on Krishna, and Krishna will manifest there. That's another thing. Go for revelation, please.
So first have the desire to go for revelation, then...
Well, you have some desire, of course, duh. You're here. Whatever desire you have, use that. It keeps increasing. So you have, let's say you have this much desire, which you obviously have more than that, but let's say you have this much desire. This much desire. You wouldn't shave off your head and put tilak on your face. So let's say you have just this much desire. So then you come to that close to Krishna. Then he'll reveal. Choose rightly. And then He removes the problem and gives you advancement. And then you have more capacity, you have more desire, and you have more capacity. Then you can get even closer to Krishna, then he can reveal more to you. Do you feel? Well, our agency is in two things: to choose to get as close to Krishna as I can according to my current desire and knowledge, and when Krishna reveals to me, to choose truth over falsity. And as you do that, things become revealed, and you'll naturally know what to do. You won't have to agonize over it. There won't be some, should I do this? That's a symptom of illusion. That kind of thing. Do this, do I have to do that? Am I really this? Am I really that? Is this my motive? Is that my motive? Is this? Does that help?
Thank you.
Okay, we're getting late on time. Yes?
How can we see, you know, with that quick, how can we see it practically? Because we try and practice, you know, these qualities of humility, tolerance, you know, all these qualities just remarkably like displayed. But from what you're saying, like, we just have the desire to, like, to connect with Krishna, to remember Krishna, then naturally Krishna will reveal it. But then how do we know it's not the mind?
Oh, good question. How do you know the difference between Krishna revealing something and the mind? How do you know the difference between real fruit juice and chemical fruit juice?
Taste it.
How do you know?
Taste.
Can you tell the difference?
One starts as poison.
And just let's talk about just juice. Can you tell the difference between fresh squeezed orange juice and orange flavored chemical water?
Yes.
Now, if you've only had orange flavored chemical water, you might think that was real orange juice. But once you've had real orange juice, you won't make that mistake again. So once you've had even a little taste of something real, the quality of it is so vastly different from the false. It has some different, inexplicable, indescribable. How do you describe the difference between fresh squeezed orange juice and orange flavored water chemicals? How do you describe it? They're both wet. But there's. I remember the first time I had a tree ripened, organically grown, locally grown peach. I think I was like 21. It's like, wow, I never had a peach before in my life. So Krishna revelation feels vastly different. So how does Krishna describe it? He describes it as Raja Vijaya, Raja Guriyam, Pavitram, Idam Uttamam, Pratyaksha, Vadamam, Dharam, Susukam, Kartimamiyam. He describes it as Pavitram. It's very purifying. Very purifying. Pratyaksha, you're directly experiencing truth and purification. Susukam, it's very happy. Then objectively, revelations from Krishna are going to be in line with Shastra, they're going to be in line with the saints, they're going to be in line with Guru. You know, if you think Krishna is revealing to you that you should push people off of rooftops, then it's not Krishna. So, you know, you have something objective from the scriptures and the saints and the Guru. And then you have the subjective experience that you experience that it's true and it's real and it's genuine. The mind is full of doubts and fears and distraction. What I do see often with people is that, you know, they'll go to Krishna, they'll say, Krishna, please show me what is my next step. And Krishna will show them. If they want to know, always he'll show them. And when people get a revelation, they always know it's a real revelation. I haven't seen any time when people don't know. They always know. But then the mind can kick in and say, are you sure? Maybe it's like this, maybe it's like that. Maybe, what about this? What about that? What about the mind is going to give you all these fears. Now maybe it's like that. Well, what will happen if you do this? What will happen if then this will happen and that will happen? And that's going to be way too hard. There's no way you can do that. Oh, that's so easy. You don't have to bother with that. You don't know how to do that. How are you going to do that? It's climbing much too hard is going to take us way too long. And it's so important. You have to have that problem. If you didn't have that problem, you'd probably quit school. And then what would happen? You wouldn't get a job. And don't even think about it. You can do it later when you're pure, but now I'll put it aside. Or just think, if looking at this problem is so painful, getting rid of it will be so painful. And it'll probably hurt forever and ever and ever, and you'll just be suffering forever getting rid of this thing, and it won't even go away all the time. You remember when you tried to do that other thing and you really worked at it so hard, and it hurt for so long, and you didn't even get rid of it all the way? That's what it'll be like. So just think about it. That's what the mind says. That's the mind. And in this case, your mind is not your friend. Just tell it to shut up. And say, I'm not listening to you. I'm not listening to all these fears. I'm not listening. But Krishna is very, it's very, very clear. It's extremely clear. And Krishna has many ways of making, of revealing. You know, you can read something in the Shastra and it's like it jumps out of the page. And you go, wow. Or it can be something someone else says. It can be something in a Shastra class. It can be somebody at the token booth at the underground. You know, it can be any, somebody says something and you're like, oh. Wow, that's me. It can be something while you're chanting that just comes in your heart. It can be while you're eating prasadam. Krishna has unlimited ways of revealing to people. But at the time, it's always clear that it's Krishna. It's never not clear. And then you have, of course, Sadhu Shastra Guru, the fence of Sadhu Shastra Guru. And the experience of the mind is a very different experience. The mind is jumping and is full of fear. It's full of pride and it's full of fear. It feels quite different. So anybody else? Did you have a question? Yes. I'm going to take one or two more and then you have to stop. Yes.
I wanted to ask, like, how do we encourage like children to chant? Because
that, my dear friend, is another seminar. I apologize, but that's really way off the topic. Well, just say very briefly, you should love chanting yourself, but let's have that. I do have a seminar, How to Encourage Your Children to Chant. It's like another hour and a half. As it is already 8:10. I do have seminars loaded on ISKCON Desire Tree, so you can go there. Go to ISKCON Desire Tree, go to audio, go to ISKCON Mataji's, and go to Urmila Mataji, and you will probably find it there. Sorry. I'm sorry. Just want to see if anyone who didn't ask anything. Yes?
Thank you for the wonderful seminar, Mataji. You were speaking about that, how going through the for the karma yoga process, that you change your nature. Do you mean in the sense that you purify your consciousness, or do you mean in the sense that you go from changing?
Okay, life? Thank you for clarifying that. In the karma yoga process, do you change your nature? What you do in karma yoga is you use your nature for transcendence rather than for materialism. So in karma yoga, you're still doing your same occupation, unless it's a sinful occupation. Still going through the different life stages, which are varna and ashram, but instead of doing it, it's karma palatyaga. Instead of doing it for yourself to enjoy the fruit of doing it, which is I want to be happy in this life and the next in the material world, you're doing it for the sake of liberation. So, you know, you're still acting, if you're a person who wants to work in government, you're still working in government. But instead of working in government, so everybody will praise you and there'll be a statue put up for you in the park. And, you know, you'll have your name in the history books or whatever. Instead of doing it for that reason, you're working in government because you want to become purified. You're just simply trying to serve the people for the sake of becoming purified. You're not looking to enjoy something on the material level for it. So what you're changing is what modes you're operating in. You're moving up from ignorance to passion to goodness to transcendence. So that you're changing in that sense. But you're not changing your body, and you're not changing your basic psychological tendencies. So if you're a shy person, you'll still be a shy person. If you're an outgoing person, you'll still be an outgoing person. You know, if you like working with numbers, you'll still like working with numbers. That kind of thing will not change. Changing that in one lifetime is almost impossible. Don't waste your time. It's not even very important. Is that clear? Thank you for asking that question. It's an important question. Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Very similar Mataji ki jai.